This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they made on our behalf, to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way, learn a thing or two and also be inspired by how much these brave men and women love our country. And we're going to get a great story today from a 90-year-old Navy veteran of World War II. He was in before the war started and after the war ended. But let's go back before that. Growing up in Columbus, Kansas, Neil Green, what was life like as Neil Green in Columbus, Kansas during the Depression years?
Well, it was pretty rough. There weren't any jobs to have, and I had no future there. Is one of the reasons I joined the Navy. Many of us did, because it was a way out of the poverty, and it was a tough situation. Much like they are today, their economic circumstances were such that we had little choice to do with our lives except that kind of thing. It opened us up, and I had no idea what it would open us up to because the war hadn't started yet. But it started pretty soon after that. The fever was there. We knew about Hitler, and we knew about the war, and we knew that that was going to happen sooner or later. And when the war started, I had joined the Navy, and I was stationed in Panama aboard a World War I, called it four-pipe destroyer. It had four stacks. And they weren't much, in modern warfare, they were fast, but they didn't have any armament. They're tin cans, and that's called the Tin Can Navy.
And you would serve on a couple tin cans before you're done. I want to get one more thing on Kansas before we move on. You know, folks obviously think of Kansas in the 1930s, I guess, and they think of maybe the Wizard of Oz, and you're not in Kansas anymore. And you saw some storms, and in fact, people have heard of the Dust Bowl. And I don't know if people today really understand what that was like, but it was so bad you even had school canceled?
In a town that's quite away from the biggest part of the sandstorm, which was western Kansas, and we were in eastern Kansas, but it came over to there. It's just like a fog bank coming in. The street lights were turned on, but they were ineffective. It was almost total darkness in the middle of the day from the sandstorms, but our farms were wrecked like they were in there, where, you know, sand would take over the whole farm and the town. So it was an economic hardship for everybody, and everything seemed to be happening to those poor people in that time.
And you joined the Navy at just 17 years old. Had you graduated from high school yet?
No, I didn't graduate from high school. Then I joined before I graduated. And I've since got my college degree, and I have a high school diploma, but it was done at night school.
What was it about the Navy? Was it just a chance to get out there and see the world, an adventure? What was it that the Navy in particular did to draw you?
Well, I blame Frank Sinatra and Gene for Here Comes the Navy. You know, it was, for a boy in landlocked Kansas, it was the dream, but there were propaganda films, and Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra and all of those people made films like that, and so I just seemed like the thing to do, and I could go, so I did.
And your years in the Navy were exactly like the movies, right?
Yeah, I saw the world all right, but I saw it from very little of the land part. I was at sea almost all the time I was in. I was never stationed on a land-based station. And we went from the North Atlantic. We went, as a matter of fact, we sunk 14 submarines. The ship I was on, the little fleet I was on, sunk 14 submarines in the Atlantic, and that four-piper.
This is early on in the war, and not a part of the war that we hear about too often, because we hear about Europe and we hear about the Pacific, and people don't realize how much was going on a little closer to home. And as we get into that, one question I ask every veteran that I interview, because everyone seems to have a memory about December 7th, 1941. Not so many of them were already in like you were. Were you already down in the Caribbean when Pearl Harbor happened?
I was in Panama, and I remember walking. We were at the service dock fixing the ship up to get underway. I walked out on the forecastle where the officer of the deck was standing, and I said, "What's happening?" Because they were recalling. They had recall signals up on all the ships there at the— it was Sunday morning, and the people were ashore, and they were recalling them to their battle stations on the ships. And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, one of our naval bases has called Pearl Harbor. Well, I had no idea where Pearl Harbor didn't. Actually, he didn't either. It was a big thing if you were there, but the rest of the Navy didn't know that much about it unless you were in the Pacific, and we were in the Atlantic Fleet then, so I can remember it vividly. I can still see him standing on the deck and me questioning him about Pearl Harbor. We got underway late that night, but we didn't have any ammunition aboard, so we began to take ammunition, and people were falling over the side and falling down hatches. They weren't used to the blackout conditions. We thought that Panama would get it next. And we had old ships there. There wasn't any good ships, modern ships there, much as we were, old four-piper cruisers. And we all got underway. That was the days before radar, and we stood our watches. I remember standing watching the crow's nest and spotting a ship through the mist, and we followed around till daylight broke, and we were ready to launch a torpedo attack, and we found out it was our own ship. But we did things like going into all of these little harbors all up and down the Central America and South America, and getting the Japanese fishing ships out and taking them into Panama and making mine detection ships out of them. And that was an adventure. That was nice. Galapagos Islands or Galapagos Islands. We used to have boat races in the bay around there. So there was some pleasure in that. Then we'd go through the locks and go over to the Atlantic, which was much rougher seas. We spent a lot of time between Brazil and Africa and moved up to the North Atlantic and anti-submarine things. And those big convoys that coming out of Cuba, we in Guantanamo Bay, we'd pick up maybe 150 ships, and they would have a field day. The subs would infiltrate the thing, and you'd have three or four ships. It was a given that was going to happen. Was a sad thing, but it was.
This is in, I guess, probably 1942, that you're dealing with these German U-boats everywhere. And so you guys, as a destroyer, you're one of the outer rings of defense for these convoys. What could you do to take care of these U-boats? What were you prepared for as a destroyer crew?
We had the depth charge racks, and then they kind of invented the K-gun, which shot the canisters out and they would drop some and drop the pattern out, and we could drop depth charges. We dropped depth charges, and you don't always know if you're successful or not. You can see oil come to the surface, but they had the trick of putting things through the torpedo tubes and making you think they'd sunk them, life jackets and things. So you never knew.
And you especially were in situations where you didn't know, because you had a very unique spot on that ship that you were during some of these encounters with the German U-boats. Below deck, doing what?
I was in the steering engine room, and that's in a destroyer of that class, when they make a violent turn, that part of the deck would be almost completely underwater as they maneuvered, and the engine for the steering would be going off. And it was dark down there. There was no lights, and I was down there to pump water to the surface machine guns, which we couldn't use, but that's where I was stationed. And I'm a kid from Kansas, and I was locked in. I couldn't get out until somebody let me out. And you might say I was a little bit scared.
I'd be scared. I'd be a lot scared. When you say pump the water, so these machine guns on top of the deck,
the barrels were water-cooled. They're just 50 caliber machine guns with bicycle-type mounts, and they were ineffective. They couldn't do much with them.
Well, and they couldn't do anything if you weren't pumping the water. And when you say pumping the water, you're not flipping a switch. You mean manually
back and forth up, pumping water up to cool them. And we had the cool. They were all water cooled. We had about four or five of those there, and I happened to be probably the youngest guy aboard, and I looked like I was 14, and I was 17. I was 31 before they stopped asking me for identification when I bought a pack of cigarettes,
Well, and you're looking good for 90 now. I'm trying to imagine what that felt like. And you just said you were a little scared. It had to be a pretty helpless feeling, and it's probably exhausting, too, doing all that pumping nonstop.
Well, that ship didn't have a lot of things like a modern ship does, like laundries and galleries, and everybody had their turn at peeling potatoes, and the galleries on the top side on the deck, and they didn't have bakeries. And it was pretty almost like a sailing ship. It was a pretty old ship. It was fast, and it could drop lots of depth charges, and that's what we were designed to do, is protect against anti-submarines. And it was scary, and the tin can thing was, you know, we'd sleep on the decks because we thought that we might get blown up. I mean, that was it was a fear we had. The German U-boat fleets were very, very clever, and we lost a ship almost every night out of a convoy. We'd lose a ship. Fleets were very, very clever, and we lost a ship almost every night out of a convoy. We'd lose a ship.
So you slept on the decks because if you slept below deck and you got hit, you'd have no chance to survive.
Exactly. And we, at that time, everybody was issued hammocks. When we went through boot camp, we slept in hammocks. They since then eliminated canvas. But we had our own hammocks that we could string between the stanchions on the ship, and we'd go up there to sleep because you'd be trapped in it. It had no armament at all down below. It was literally a tin can.
And I guess with the tropical weather, it was warm enough that you could sleep in the outdoors like that.
It was very hot. Inside, they had wind sails hoisted, and most sailors today wouldn't even know what a wind sail is, but it scooped up the air in a funnel and put it down. But we didn't. And we came from the tropics to the North Atlantic, and we still didn't have anything. We didn't have heaters or coolers or anything. It was just we went where they told us to go, and it was the basic getting ready for the war. The ship that I was on later was a modern seafaring warrior ship. On the first ship I was on, the first guys aboard had duty of feeding the crew. You'd have to go up on the deck and get the food and bring it down to the living quarters and then feed the crew. You were a mess cook, and everybody had to have their turn at mess cooking, and all the seamen.
How'd you do on yours?
It was kind of rough. I mean, when the ship goes up like this and you're going down a ladder with food, racks of food in your hand, they give away twice as much as they did when they came up, or vice versa. Yeah. So it was a basic ship, and we were all pretty hardy guys. I thought I was a real tough sailor, and I'd go around with, thinking I was a salty, and then I'd go into a store down in Panama or something, and I'd hear a lady say, "Oh, look at that young boy in his sailor suit. I thought I was pretty tough, but."
Well, and along those lines, you mentioned you joined the Navy at 17 and you only looked 14. What about the rest of the guys on your ship? Did you have some of those older, saltier Navy sailors who had been in a while, and how did they treat this young boy from Kansas?
Well, a lot of the guys aboard ship were from the old Asiatic fleets, and to me they were ancient, but I don't suppose. The captain was probably 28 or 29 or 30, you know. Everybody was old when you're 17. Everybody's old, but we had gunner's mates and bosun mates that were in the old Asiatic Navy. Some of them had their teeth and some of them didn't. I mean, it's tattoos, and it was the old sailor type of thing. And then they began to get in the groups of reserves from New Jersey and places like that. So the younger people took over the ship, but there were still salty old sea dogs there. I don't know. They tolerated us. That's about the size of it. They tolerated us.
And you mentioned the U-boat threat and how ever present that was, and how much fear that incited in you guys. To put that in perspective, you said there were situations where you guys as a destroyer would actually be rescuing the sailors from a ship that a U-boat had sunk when you saw another ship sunk right next to it.
That's true. As a matter of fact, when we were in the North Atlantic, which was a typical convoy type thing, we were with a group. We had one Jeep aircraft carrier, that's a converted carrier that would carry maybe six or eight planes, and we were looking for submarines. But at that time we had a good idea where they would be, and one of our sister ship, there were two destroyers, our sister ship rammed one of the submarines, and they were locked together, and this was quite a newsworthy thing. They were knocked together, and we had to destroy our own ship when we tried to get the crew off the ship, and the Germans had picked up an Italian U-boat that we'd sunk. He'd picked up the crew from that, so we had Italians and prisoners and German prisoners, and the captain of our sister ship decided he wasn't going to abandon ship, he was going to save it. Well, they cut off the torpedo tubes in the guns, and they saw they weren't going to save it, so late in the day, they decided they'd abandon ship, and they put a line between the two ships, of course, in the North Atlantic. The waves are tremendous, and you don't last more than 30 minutes in the water. But so the ships parted and snapped the line when there were a lot of life rafts in it, and it was beginning to get dark, and And we'd leave the aircraft carrier, and the subs would go to the surface and chase the aircraft carrier, and we'd pick up some people and run over and get the, drive the sub down and come back to pick up sailors. And it's some we didn't pick up. I remember the next morning we came across a life raft that had about 12 sailors in it. They were all dead. So I saw the captain of their ship, which we'd taken over, and he was really shaken by it. We all were. We couldn't stop to give them any service or anything. They just took a grappling hook and turned the life raft upside down and went away. That was war. That was the war. It was a sad thing.
That seems like an awful lot to digest as a teenager. Was there anything that helped you process that, deal with it? Did it just toughen you up? Did you become numb to it after a while? Or how did you endure those kind of moments?
We endured them because of our patriotism, which seems kind of corny today, but we thought that if I die, the people on my block back in Kansas will think what a hero I am, and he did something for his country, which was really important to us. So we're all driven by a patriotic thing, love of country. We see the flag in a strange country, a hair would stand up on the back of your head. I mean, it sounds corny now, but the love of country and Bing Crosby and all of the things that went with the love of country were prevalent then, and that's what we did it for. We were proud of what we were doing, and we knew it was essential, and fortunately, we're speaking English here now instead of German.
Amen. Or Japanese. And you had your encounters with both sides of that, and there aren't many people who experienced Navy battles against both the Germans and Japanese, and there certainly aren't a lot of them still alive today. So we're thankful for the perspective you can share with us here. But right now, we need to catch a break. We're going to find out how Neil Green ended up on a brand new destroyer and experienced most of the Pacific War aboard that ship when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.